the length and gauge of the wires between the power supply and the rig could cause problems if they're not fixed, if they're too long and too thin.
Did you get that, Barry? Ed was commenting on you can have voltage drops if you either have a really long power wire or it has a very small gauge, because both of those situations puts a significant resistance on the power line, and so when you run current through it, you'll have a voltage drop.
That could possibly be, but either way, a power supply made for hams should be able to withstand the RF. That's my my feeling.
Okay, I think ultimately none of these are really designed for people with antennas nearby the power supply. I think the specs that some people have mentioned for isolation of a power supply box is pretty good. It's about 120 decibels. So it drops it by one with 12 zeros, which is good. But if you're going to have the power supply, a foot or 2 feet away from a radiating antenna, sometimes, unfortunately, the wires leading into it from the transmitter will pick up more than enough to get you back there and cause you problems. So once again, in addition to Ed's comment about it's always a good idea to keep power supply lines short as they can be, and use good size gauge conductors. Again, I hate to sound like the RF choke guy, but it might help you to put a couple of RF chokes at the power cable outlet of the power supply to kind of limit the RF that gets back into those boxes. They're designed with a lot of intelligence, unfortunately, in some ways. So the RF gets misinterpreted as overvoltaging and can cause it to shut down or lock up. Again, this is not an uncommon situation. So sometimes you just have to help the engineers a little bit.
WB2EAU, another comment.
Yes, Ed, what is your comment?
Roy, yes or no? Did he say he has the antenna within a foot or two of the power supply?
Yes, he has the antenna inside.
No problem at all. Military fighter aircraft have this exact problem, and they solve it by putting in all kinds of shielding, all kinds of filtering, all kinds of chokes. Only costs about $50,000 an aircraft. I suggest, if that exceeds your budget, you just try separating the two.
I am going to try to separate them. That was the second question I wanted to ask, was discussing an outdoor arrangement for an antenna, but this was temporary until I could mount something.
Okay, you could ask it nevertheless if you want to. I just add in for kind of dubious, questionable, you can't move anything around, throw some RF chokes at it, because again, doesn't really cause you any problems. But as Ed mentioned, the farther away that you can put the antenna from the rest of your equipment, the better. And if you certainly can find some way of putting it outdoors, outdoors is pretty much always much better than indoors. As someone who has a house that was plastered in the old style of chicken wire and then plaster smeared on it, it makes for a great Faraday cage, but it is not a good environment for an antenna. When I was setting up an antenna, I did it in the shack to just kind of see what its reception was, and it was awful. I took it out to my backyard. It was much better, even without elevation.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm now in the process of trying to set up a dipole and I'm hoping I'll have enough room. I have a small lot, but I'm hoping I can possibly fit in 80 if I tie it to a tree in the front and a tree in the back of the house, then run it over the roof and maybe on the where the chimney is to get a little more height and a little more length for the wires before they slack. But I'm trying to, my plan is just to take a ladder line and cut it down the middle and spread it into a T, and then that will be the dipole, because you see that everybody's using ladder lines connected to heavy center insulators and feed points and adding extra weight and extra coupling and soldering, and I don't understand why people want to make life complicated. Why not just cut the ladder line and spread each one to the right and to the left, and then you have the center is the rest of your ladder line uncut, and that goes into the shack, and it can go through or under a window sill, which is an advantage of ladder line over coax. You can close your window, I assume, pretty much all the way.
Okay, Barry. Yes, you can do it that way. It's not as rugged, though, as you can imagine, because you have to think in terms of you're connecting two legs of your, either it's a resonant dipole or a non-resonant doublet. It needs to be secured at both ends, and a lot of secure objects like a tree move around. The wind blows them, so that puts a lot of stress on the center portion. It might rip down the center. It might rip down the side and cause problems with the actual conductor. So it's not going to be quite as rugged as you might want it to be. Also, if you have a vinyl window, yes, you can slide it right over the vinyl window. If your window has metal on it, you really don't want to put a metal window and windowsill and such and clamp it right next to an open wire or window pane type of wire, because it's going to have coupling problems and it's not going to be good. You have to offset open wire transmission lines away from other conducting materials when you're feeding it into your shack.
And that's what everybody is saying, but I did see one report saying that the very small area of contact is perpendicular to the window sill, and it's just a tiny run may not be so critical. I won't know until I try it. But one of my questions is, I found a manufacturer that makes 14-gauge ladder line, which is much heavier, I guess, than the normal is 18-gauge. And so this will give it extra strength, and I'm also hoping it'll give it a higher power rating for possible use of a linear. But I'm wondering, you know, when the manufacturers say this dipole is rated for 100 watts, this is rated for 1,000, I don't even know what their criterion is, because some of them seem to be using very similar gauge wires, and one's calling it 100, one's calling it 1,000. I don't know who's deciding what the maximum power capability is of these various dipoles.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of these numbers come out of the marketing department and not the technical department, to the point that the ARRL will not allow advertisers to advertise the gain of their antennas in their magazine because they feel that the gains are not really proved. So it's probably the same thing to a degree with the power capability, although I would hope that manufacturers would be somewhat conservative, because otherwise people would take their linears out and burn up a lot of antennas. It has to do with the type of conductor the antenna is made of. It has to do with tuning networks and impedance matching and traps and phasing cables and impedance matching circuits and balance that are built into the design of the antenna. So it's not necessarily just the gauge of the radiating antenna, but it can be the impedance matching circuitry that's hidden at some point in the antenna itself. Yes, Ed.
ladder line is wonderful stuff in specific applications. I'm not hearing applications here. It sounds to me like he wants to put up a simple dipole next to the house in limited space, coax and, you know, and basic hookup wire, ideally 14 gauge, but then it's fine. Is all he really needs, and I've told a lot of newbies who want to get on HF, start with a 40-meter dipole, 66 feet overall, 33 feet on the side with some RG58. It's nice, it's cheap, it's simple, and yes, it does get out.
Okay, I mean, that's certainly a good idea. I kind of think that Barry wants to kind of do the ultra-simple, vaguely similar to the people who use zip wires, and they just kind of pull them apart, and you know, so that he doesn't want to have a center post with a 259 connector and stuff like that. He just wants it a kind of a unibody approach to this design.
That's why I just want something simple, and I think that having less weight will actually make it more rugged, because all these other things that you can stick in the middle of it at the feed point will weigh it down and cause problems, possibly. So I just thought, keep life simple. But another question I wanted to ask was about lightning protection. I was just looking at one of the tuners. MFJ says that any electrical storm, you should disconnect the ladder line. Now, if I disconnect it from the house and from the tuner, it's going to be hanging in the house, and I don't know if that's safe for lightning either. So I'm just wondering what most people are doing in storms. Are they actually disconnecting their feed lines outdoors?
Well, I mean, theoretically, the best approach to lightning protection, other than simply putting in lightning protection in the transmission lines themselves, and there are companies, I think DX Engineering and Array Solutions sell open line lightning protection devices, so you can put that on the outside and not have to worry about it. But some people just short out their cables, they leave them open, and in severe cases you take them and hang them out the other end. You know, it depends upon if you're a belt suspenders and staple gun type of a person, or if you're just a belt guy. You know, I would suggest if you're concerned about lightning protection, you should look towards external lightning protection measures, because those are probably the safest, because the discharge takes place away from your house and not inside it and around it.
I saw some of those boxes, and it's possible. You have to then, you know, cut the cable and screw the conductors to the box in the middle and splice it sort of with this box. But I don't know what it's going to do to the signal. I hope that it doesn't mess up the signal at all. I don't know how well they've tested it. Another question I had was, if you leave the feed line floating, is that more or less likely to attract lightning than if I ground it inside the house by, let's say, or rely on the braid of the coax or whatever it is that's going to the transmitter, and the transmitter's grounded? I'm just wondering, are you more likely to attract lightning when it's grounded or when it's floating, when the feed line is totally disconnected and floating? It could be the ground will attract more lightning, I'm not sure.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I find it's both. You know, I just disconnect my, I just unscrew the PL259 in the back if I'm really worried about a lightning storm coming through. But there's a good reason to actually leave it hooked up. You could leave it, over the years lately I got lazy. I just leave it hooked up, and I don't disconnect it anymore. In the beginning, I said disconnect it if I saw a storm coming. But, you know, if you leave it connected, and like he said, if your rig is grounded, mine's grounded to the to the heating system. That means any wind that's going by outside, that bleeds off electrons normally. And if that happens, it's better to have a ground that compensates for that. Where if you don't have, if it's not grounded, there might be a chance that it might get hit with lighting. So it's about 50-50 from what I see. So over the years, I went from unplugging it like a madman every time there was a storm to leaving it plugged in, hoping that because it's grounded, I'm not going to build up a charge on the antenna. You disconnect it, you're going to tend to build up a charge on the antenna. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you, Paul. In addition, if it's a reasonably well-engineered lightning arrester, it shouldn't really give you any problems with your signal. Usually these are little gas discharge tubes that when they reach a high voltage potential short out. Matter of fact, they sell dipoles and they sell just the center post of a make-it-yourself dipole that has a built-in lightning arrester gas discharge tube built into the center column material. So, if you're interested and want the belt and suspenders, that's a better way to go than attaching things inside your shack. If you give the lightning a good place to go inside your shack, then it's going to go inside your shack, and you don't want it to go inside your shack.
And one other comment, Roy.
Yeah, sure, Paul.
I used to disconnect the PL-259 from one of the connectors, and, on a breezy day, just leave it there for a minute or two, and you can tell there's a charge building up because you make the room kind of dark and you put that connector, just start to put it back, you'll see a little spark, an eighth of an inch or less sometimes, so that gives you an idea that there is a charge building up on that antenna. Meanwhile, you're not connected to anything. You could take all your radios out of the room, have your just have this antenna, going to a potential ground. And when you go near that, you can see a little teeny spark, then it goes away, and you wait a couple more minutes, and it comes back again. It's fascinating. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, static electricity is sort of fun to play with. I have a Wilmers machine that cranks up a lot of volts. Static will give you a large number of voltage potential differences, but thankfully a very, very, very low current most of the time when it's not lightning, when it's just static. So that's why you could, when you rub your feet on carpeting and touch the doorknob, you see the spark and you feel it, but it doesn't really cause any problems, after the event.
Oh, yeah, I remember you talked about that machine. I think Dick had one, too. I thought John had one, too. W2BG. Yeah, he had one, too. I remember seeing it on his... when you look up his QSL, he had that thing as one of the things on his... that you could scroll down and look at. Oh, you still have that. Okay. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I heard those stories. Back to you, Roy. I'll be listening.
Yes, indeed. It's loads of fun. It works better in the winter than the summer because the relative humidity has an effect of bleeding off the static charge. But other than that, it's loads of fun. And John had one as well. We all kind of talked about it. And many times me and Dick would discuss the curious nature that there is no particular polarity to these machines. They basically just randomly select the charge at the beginning, and as you crank them, the voltage potential difference grows greater and greater. But one probe is not inherently positive, and the other isn't inherently negative. So very curious machines, loads of fun, though.
Just saw one in a movie in the background. There's a movie called The Current Wars. The movie between Westinghouse and Edison, you know, the war between the two of them. And they showed in the background that he had one of those things sitting on a desk. I don't know what it was doing in this movie, but I don't know. Maybe they played with them back then. I don't know. But very good, boy. I'll be listening. Continue.
Hey, Paul, WB2EAP, will comment about current wars.
Sure, Ed. Let it rip.
They make a big deal about Tesla's three-phase AC motors versus Edison's DC motors, and yet they kept saying how the AC motors are so much more expensive than DC motors. My experience is the exact opposite, and I think it applies then too. And I never did quite figure out where any of that was coming from, and that whole thing about lethality, I believe, is absolute nonsense. And they never explained any of that in that movie.
Right. Do I have it?
Yeah, certainly, Paul.
Yeah, I was expecting a lot more for that point. There was very little technical stuff as far as I was concerned. That movie was a disappointment. But with a name like that, I had to watch it. Hey, I did learn one thing. I found out what the nickname of his Edison's son and daughter was. Roy, do you know that? Do you have that answer? That would be a good trivia question. Meanwhile, I know Ed knows because he saw the movie.
No, I do not. I remember I loved the biography that Spencer did back in, what is it, the 50s or the 40s?
Okay, very good. I bet Ed remembers that. I'm going to be listening. I know you're trying to... I got you off topic somehow. Back to you.
I wasn't as depressed as you are. I can't remember it.
Oh, I doubled with him. What did he say?
I said, no, I don't remember it. I guess I didn't find it as clever as you did.
Oh, okay. I mean, they would, you know, they had real names, but they would call them one dot and the other one dash.
Oh, yeah, now I remember, right.
Must have been a curious household. Again, if anyone has nothing better to do, check out the old Spencer Tracy biography on Edison. It's probably historically completely inaccurate, but it was very entertaining at the time. Anyway, let's try a little puzzle, you know, in case anyone's in the mood. This was suggested by a listener, Bill, W2SAW. And the question is simply, at the circumference of the Earth at the equator is approximately 24,901 miles. If you built a one-foot bridge above that line of the equator, what would be the increase in the circumference at the top of that one-foot bridge or one-foot wall?
You're talking about adding 2 feet to the diameter.
Say again?
You're just adding 2 feet to the diameter of the Earth, and then you go...
Okay, so but the question is, what's the difference in the circumference from the ground to the wall? That's 1 foot high.
I'm trying to understand the question. I always say 25,000 miles. What are you saying it is?
Wait a minute. I think the difference is 6.28 feet.
Yes, or in other words, 2 pi. If you take a look at the circumference of any sphere is 2 pi r. So let's make r the radius of the Earth at the equator. So the question would be, what's 2 pi times r plus 1, because that's the 1 foot more, minus the old circumference, which is 2 pi r. So 2 pi r plus 1 minus 2 pi r is 2 pi, or 6.28, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the answer is 2 pi. Let's try another one. This is just a linguistic one. It is a common expression. I was just wondering if anyone knows where the heck it came from. The line is pulling out all the stops.
NY2JJ.
Yes, NY2JJ.
That's a reference to pipe organs.
Yes, indeed. Very good. It's a pipe organ term. The stops are valves that control the wind going through the pipes. So by pulling out the stops, you let the air go through them, and it makes the sound from the pipe organ louder and more powerful. So pulling out all the stops is a term that originated in pipe organs, and you are quite correct.
KE2NVP.
Yes, Bob.
There's a slightly off-color joke I could tell based on that, if it's okay. It's just slightly off-color, and it's kind of cute.
Well, give it a try.
A well-known musicologist determined that the reason J.S. Bach had 20 children is because he didn't have any stops on his organ.
Okay, that was amusing, and I don't think it violated anything FCC-wise. Yeah, unfortunately, Ed, you're about 95% noise until the very last sentence. So whatever direction you wiggle that antenna, wiggle it in the last direction and ask your question.
I have heard one explanation for the phrase "the whole nine yards." And I'm wondering if anybody has an alternate. Should I explain the one I've heard, or wait to see what other people throw out?
Well, why don't you tell the one that you heard, and anyone who has a different representation can add theirs to the mix.
WS2N. Oh, okay.
The one I heard was the bullets in a machine gun, a Gatling type of gun. The whole length of it was, you know, all the bullets, if you were to line them all up, you know, before they go through the gun, they were 9 yards long. So that's where I heard it. Back to you, Roy.
That's very close to what I heard.
Okay, I think Wikipedia has a different opinion.
Well, let me just expand what Roy said. The way I heard it was the World War II bombers, the B-17s and the B-24s, the defensive machine guns had ammo belts that were 9 yards long. So if they came back from a mission with lots of holes in the fuselage, and they say they used the whole 9 yards, to me it was a really bad mission.
Okay, also, if you travel down the rabbit hole that is Wikipedia, They mentioned that the first non-idiomatic use of the phrase goes back to 1855, and has to do with the judge's big shirt. It says, "What a silly, stupid woman. I told her to get just enough to make three shirts. Instead of making three, she has put the whole 9 yards into one shirt." And then they also cite a reference in, I think, 1905 regarding the baseball games.
AF2P with another opinion.
Yes, please, opinion away.
I heard it had to do with a bolt of cloth. The bolt of cloth was 9 yards long, and when you bought just enough for one shirt or whatever, you were buying less, but you could also buy the whole 9 yards.
Okay, I mean, that's basically the same thing as the 1855 article, the judge's big shirt, because that was the point, that instead of making more than one shirt, the person just made one shirt with the whole 9 yards.
K2GJE.
Yes, Ed.
Where did the term church tea come from? The beer bottle opener over.
Okay, could you mention that again? Because I don't recognize it as a term, but you know, I'm not that big a beer aficionado.
Church tea.
Is that K-I-R-S-T-H? Wait, is that K-I-R-S-T-H or church, as in the house of worship?
Church, as in the house of worship, over.
I've heard it, but I have no idea the origin.
Okay, once again, Google is your friend, and Wikipedia, I guess, as well. So they actually do have an entry for it. It says the term in the beverage opening sense is apparently not an old one. Merriam-Webster finds written attestation only since the 1950s. Several etymological themes exist. The main one is that the end of some bottle openers resemble the heads of large keys, such as have traditionally been used to lock and unlock church doors.
I'll buy that. You're the first one that ever answered my question. Thank you. Over. This is K2GJE.
You're welcome, Ed. As I tell everyone, Google is our friend. You just need to have a well-calibrated BS meter, because every so often you can fall into a really deep rabbit hole. But as long as it's well-calibrated, the Internet is a very useful service of information. It's kind of like having an infinite number of librarians at your wake and call. And I like it for so many different reasons, one of which goes back to my days as a resident in a hospital. Back in the 80s, we didn't have an Internet, so when guys got drunk in bars and had questions of a medical nature, they would actually waste the time of medical personnel by randomly calling ERs and asking the doctor to settle a bet that they had going on at the bar. So I'm very thankful for the Internet on many levels.
Intake channel, are you ready?
Yes, yeah, certainly, Wes. Have a go at it.
Okay. And to XGN. So we have a few news from the science world. Nothing special, but at least something. Mighty Buildings is a construction technology company based in Oakland, California. And they decided to have a mass production of 3D printing, robotics, and automation. They have created a venture capital series of firms, and big money were invested there. They were huge 3D printers, and they used thermoset composites called light stone material that hardens when exposed to ultraviolet light, making it more effective building material than concrete. The good thing is that when building such a house, the 93 to 95 percent of work hours is gone. A 3D printer makes entire house. So they have a 79,000 square foot food facility and received approval on the California factory built housing program, as well as first UL certification under the new standards for 3D printed construction. It can create 3D printed house quicker and more efficiently, and it sells it out for around $115,000 for a studio, and as low as $285,000 for three bedroom or two very large bedrooms. If you live in inflated housing market, I'd say in California, that is a cost benefit immediately. Few words from technicality of it. Composite materials are highly anisotropic, unlike most traditional engineering materials, which allows for the reinforcements to be placed only where needed in inefficient design. So actually those walls are empty hollows, but they are in the structure of a honeycomb. If I say this word properly, and the cure materials is simultaneously produced with the structure by limiting ability to modify the material following the completion of its manufacturing. So it's a light that makes polymers harden. And that process is unreversible. It's not a new technology. In 1991, 1994, the average annual growth rate for those thermosetting composites in U.S. was 8.9% and was slowly growing. And right now, we have a huge need for it. And it is about $70 billion value that is expected to grow to $42 billion by year 2022. Some information about the cost. So one bed, one bath is 350 square feet is $183,750, and 700 square feet is $239,500. Two bed, one bath is about $249,000, and it is turnkey, ready to move, and nothing you need to buy, with all appliances installed, even with washer and dryer. And then we're going to much more expensive, which would be three bed and two bath, and that would be 1,440 square feet, and that would be 24 by 60, and turnkey price is $409,500. Any questions? Diamonds. Echo 3CT Thunder to grow diamonds made entirely from the sky. So UK millionaire Dale Vinci, D-A-L-E Vinci, V-I-N-C-E. Well, he decided to grow diamonds from air. And how does he do it? Is there a plan to create thousands of carats of carbon-negative laboratory-grown diamonds every year made entirely from the sky? Delvins, the founder of Green Energy Supply Ecotricity, E-C-O-T-R-I-C-I-T-Y, Ecotricity, claims to have developed the world's only diamonds to be made from carbon, water, and energy sourced directly from the elements at a sky mining facility in Stroud, Stroud. The green technology first uses carbon dioxide captured directly from atmosphere from the diamonds, which are chemically identical to diamonds mined from the earth. Using wind and solar electricity with water collected from the rainfall. The total energy usage comparing to cost comes on plus. That means that the total energy extracted from solar panels and windmills that is used for the process and then used to create diamonds versus value of the diamonds is lesser and gives to that millionaire huge amount of money in profit. So a few words about, it's very little information how those diamonds are made, but what I was able to find out is we have a solar panel, so we have electrical energy, and then we create a methane from the carbon from air. Then this is a green technology, which actually is helping to make the air cleaner. Then the methane is treated by plasma and high pressure. And what is found is the diamond doesn't need too much of carbon in it. And that is sufficiently enough to mass production of diamonds. Any questions?
AC2GS, what do you mean by diamonds don't need carbon? Diamonds are 100% carbon. I don't quite understand.
In the production of the diamond, the amount of carbon extracted compared to the volume is not really huge. But if we go to the production, okay, the power generating waste, inclination, planet, whatever, the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, some of the CO2 that goes to the production facility, which is another company, Fast Company, that is from Chicago. They also do the same. They call it Eater. Is turning it to carbon-negative diamonds. So we look at Wikipedia for carbon-negative diamonds, we're going to end up with... I don't have a whole process in it. I'm carbon-based with carbon...
Wesley?
...of unneeded stuff. I believe I need to Google for it, or if you already did so, for carbon-negative diamonds. Did you?
AC2GS, I think what you're getting at is the carbon footprint, because it makes no sense for a diamond to be a negative carbon. I don't even know what that is. I assume this is market speech for a technology that creates diamonds from carbon atoms in a ecologically nicer way and has a negative carbon imprint in the technology. I think that's what they mean by carbon negative, as in footprint, not as the actual atoms themselves.
I need to admit that the term carbon negative diamond is new to me. The only one I found is first carbon negative diamonds made from air. And it's not only one company, not that millionaire, but also in Chicago. The company E called Ether, A-E-T-H-E-R. Carbon negative diamonds, breakthrough luxury. It's a patented technology. So we have at least two entities that are doing that. I'm trying to find out more scientific explanation for that. No, I don't see that. Maybe you found something.
Yeah, I see a lot of entries with the word sustainable added to it. So again, it's more of a marketing comment that it has a negative carbon footprint in the production of diamonds. Because diamonds are all the same. They're a crystalline form of carbon, three-dimensionally. Regular coal is an amorphous material. Graphene and graphite are linear arranged carbon molecules, and the crystalline carbon is diamond. One form of diamond, another form of diamond, they're all the same diamond. There's naturally occurring diamonds, and you can do all kinds of chemical maneuvers to take relatively inexpensive carbon and form crystals from seeds and grow your own diamonds. And a lot are used in an industry. And some are almost gem grade, but the companies that mine diamonds are really annoyed at that.
So, yes, that technology is new to me. I was familiar with CVT diamond and HPHT diamond. Talking about the history, it was 1879 when they were thinking about synthesized diamonds. In 1940s, United States, Sweden, and Soviet Union tried to compete with Grove Diamond. They've been able to do some good production of it in 1954, at least in small quantities. And then Soviet Union dealt in discovery of CVD diamond, which was chemical vapor, deposition vapor diamond, and HPHD diamond, which is a high-pressure, high-temperature process. I've seen those machines. One of the guys that I visited was in New York, and I was in his facility. He got killed. He was a Russian guy. Those two, so we have two processes quite known, and they still dominate production of synthetic diamonds. But then we have 1990, that was a process of detonation of carbon-containing explosive creates the nanometer-sized diamond grains that were used for production where you need a grain of diamonds. And then there was a diamond synthesis treating graphite with high-power ultrasound. But this process has no, I didn't find that process to have a commercial application. So that's what I know. But now taking carbon from air, then create a methane, then take methane, treat it with plasma and pressure, and create the diamonds, something new.
Yeah, it's something new, but probably you can sequester a heck of a lot more carbon by growing a tree.
That is correct. we're talking about a green technology that I believe deserved an attention. Let me stop. Okay. 20 years International Space Station, that was yesterday, I believe, 240 scientists, and started 2020, that would not be covered by me. So let's go forward. Okay. National Institutes of Health researchers have discovered a gene in mice that controls the craving for fatty and sugar foods and desire to exercise. The gene PRACAR2A is highly expressed in habenula and a teeny brain region involved in responses to pain, stress, anxiety, sleep, and reward. The findings could inform future research to prevent obesity and its accompanying risk to cardiovascular disease and diabetes. The study was conducted by Edra London, PhD, and staff scientists in the section of endocrinology and genetics at NIH, Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. Dr. Roy, what do you have to say about it?
I'm not sure what gene sequence you're talking about. Are you talking about the A2AR?
PRKAR2A. PRACAR2A. And that is responsible for craving. And that is discovered in mice.
Okay, I mean, they've been fiddling with mice for a while now. They've found different gene sequences that kind of give them fat mice and slightly skinnier mice. I don't know if it correlates with anything in human beings, because although, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, mice and the rest of the mammals, including ourselves, have a lot in similar. It'll be up to, I'm sure guys will try to patent, blockers for these, gene transcriptions and all kinds of fun stuff. And, we're gonna be on a brave new world with genetic engineering on many, many levels as time goes on.
The researchers determined that BRCA2A, a negative mice, eat less high fat food than their counterparts, not only when given unlimited access to the food, but also after a feast. Similarly, the PRACAR2A negative mice also drank less of sugar solution than the wild type of mice. The PRACAR2 negative mice were also more inclined to exercise, running 2-3 times longer than wild type mice on a treadmill. Female PRACAR2 negative mice were less inclined to consume high fat foods than PRACAR2 negative males, while PRACAR2 negative males showed less preference for sugar solution than PRACAR2 negative females. And to exit.
Okay, that's interesting. They've been kind of doing this kind of work with mice and these gene sequences at least for the last 5 years.
Hey, this is you and RCA.
Yes, Sam.
Hey, good evening, Roy. I don't want to interrupt, but is the space show coming on tonight?
Yes, indeed, Sam. As I mentioned earlier, at 10:15, Paul is going to give us the SpaceNet report.
Yeah, we started a little bit earlier today, so we have a little time, I believe, to go further through it. And I see you gentlemen always interrupting me, so maybe you can comment on it. You don't like the panel and to exchange?
Wesley, I think you stepped on Sam.
Yeah, there is always one gentleman who is breaking up. He did it already 5 times to me in any subject that I have, asking for the space report. I believe we have a little bit more time. I'm not being paid for my work. I'm trying to deliver. And to exchange. Okay.
Yeah, I never talk on this show. How do you mean I stepped on you? I don't do that. I don't even use this. I always listen to Roy. Roy will tell you. I never talk when you're talking. I don't understand what you're talking about.
Yes, indeed. Sam doesn't interrupt. Sam, this is the first time Sam has asked this question. Other people have asked this question, but not Sam.
Okay, my apology. And there was another gentleman who didn't wrote his call sign. Thank you very much. Okay. Plastic. It looks like every American produces 100 kilograms per year of plastic, and only 9% of that plastic is recycled. On average, we use 53 kilograms of plastic a year. So now we know that it is for this year, it's twice more. Is it because of coronavirus? I don't know. Let me drop. So we collectively produce 300 million tons of plastic waste. By 2030, this is predicted to double, with the brunt impact expected to hit our oceans. And now we know that we already have a problem with microplastic in the ocean. And we also have a dying coral reef. The report that was made a few days ago urges policy makers to draft a global legality binding agreement to stop plastic entering marine environments and to establish strong national targets to cut down on plastic use. About 40% of plastic were consumed today, and a single-use things that are most common that have those plastics, so we're not talking about tons of bottles that everybody buys. Those, fortunately, are being properly recycled. But you have plates, food containers, electronic packing. So single-use plastic simply have to go, according to the head of Oceans and Sustainable Development, Ricard Lecht. I say, any comments on that?
Well, you know, Wesley, plastic is a big problem. There's a lot of microplastic in our environment, and unfortunately, since there's no decent organisms yet that can digest most of these plastics, they tend to stay in the environment and get absorbed by living things, and it's messing things up all over the place. So they're working on genetically engineering cell lines that are able to digest certain types of plastic, and different ways of dealing with the incredible amount of it. But it's problematic. A very small amount can be reasonably recycled. So we're left with a lot of petroleum byproducts that are going to live out the next, 100,000 years as plastics in our environment.
It won't come to a surprise to you that plastic are terrible for ocean environment. According to United Nations environment experts, between 60 to 80% of the trial.